You're listening to the USEA official podcast, which takes you behind the scenes of eventing, covering all the big events, professional tips and tricks, interviews, special guests, and the latest USEA eventing news. Welcome to the USEA official podcast, and listeners, have we got a treat in store for you, because today's guest is one of the most inspirational guests we have had on the show. She is an eventing official, she is a rider, she is a judge, and she is an amputee. Melissa Warden, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you so much for having me, Nicole.
Your story is absolutely incredible, and we're going to get to how your life has changed and the impact it has had on your life. But first of all, let's get started with your love of horses, because they have been a massive part of your life over the years. Tell us about how that love affair started, and was it always something that you knew you wanted to make a career of and your life of?
So, kind of. I think horses are in my blood. My great aunt was a show jumper, and I went back and actually found her horse that she'd had, and after she passed away, was passed on to other people. I found him in the AHSA catalogs, because they used to put all of the year-end finishes in there. And so she was a big show jumper back in like the 40s through the 60s, and kind of paved the way for women there. And that was passed down to my mother and my aunt. And then when I was little, my aunt would get me riding lessons when I would visit. So I always wanted a pony, but I grew up on a boat and was trying to figure out a way that I could have a pony with the boat, which is not really conducive. So I was going to say
the two don't necessarily sort of jump hand in hand, do they?
No, not at all. Not at all. And so it's kind of weird how a little girl who grew up with parents that wanted to sail around the world in the Pacific Northwest ended up on the East Coast eventing as an official. So and having competed through what is now the 3-star level. So it's definitely been an experience through the years. And I look back and I realize what an incredible opportunity I've had, and where horses have taken me. And they've really opened doors for me that I would have never had otherwise.
So how did you make that move sort of onto dry land, in theory, and then sort of make that horses something that you wanted to pursue further?
So I was in pony club, and my father ended up becoming the course designer and course builder for our pony club horse trials back before you had to be a licensed official. And he ended up, we had a recognized horse trial through training back when it was USDTA, and he built these great fences out of marine grade wood, and I spent many days working alongside of him. And so he'd been a top skier back in his day, and an injury had removed him from the sport completely, and he knew how much I loved it, and so he was willing to give up his dream of sailing around the world so that I could ride. And at that point, I was 12, 13 years old. And so we moved onto land and had a little farm. He built the barn for me. He cleared the trees and built the arena for me. And the trees from the arena built the barn. And so he was extremely supportive of trying to help me live my dreams. But we didn't have very much money. So I sort of rode whatever horses I could find, if it was something that maybe had needed maintenance issues or special shoeing, because we had a fabulous farrier, I would ride anything. And so that's kind of where it began. So my introduction to officials was going around when they had the TD checks 6 weeks in advance at the horse trials. And so the first TD I ever spent the day with was Fran O'Reilly, who's from Vashon, Washington. And I just remember, think back, and it's like how far I've come and these people that have had an impact on my life. And then I got to work next to them one day, and it was really cool. So anyway, so Fran came out to the event, and we're going around, and she's telling my father what needs to be changed or what she likes and things that she's pleased with. And I was like, dude, I want your job. This is so cool. And I was 13 years old. And so clearly there was not like a pipeline at that point for 13-year-olds to become officials. So I went to university, got a degree in political science, was supposed to go to law school. I am the reason that children should stay in school and get a college education. Because I'm covered in hay most of the time and dirty and my shoes smell like a barn, which most horse people don't mind, but the rest of the universe really doesn't appreciate. So anyway, I worked in the political realm a little bit. I worked on some campaigns when I graduated and then realized that that was not the place for me to be. So then I worked on a fishing boat and eventually kind of got back into riding, met my husband, and he offered me either a horse or a wedding ring. And any woman would tell you what she would choose in that situation. So clearly it was the horse.
Absolutely.
And that horse ended up being sold and then purchased my first upper level horse. So took him to California. That was fabulous. He did quite well. The whole family followed at that point. And then, which was my husband and my daughter, who was 2 years old at the time. And then 2008, 2009 hit and the economy crashed. And at that point, there was something in the USDA newsletter about they were looking for officials, but I had one horse that was going intermediate and that's all I'd ever had. And I didn't have the full qualifications. So I kept it in the back of my mind and we found a place in Aiken. I ended up moving across country because if you're going to try to be the best, you need to live among the best. And Aiken, South Carolina has been home to Olympians since before the 1996 Olympics when the Australians came here and trained. So this was sort of the place to be, and property was affordable. And so I made the move across country with this horse and his full brother, who at that time was going novice, and ended up having two upper level horses and acquiring all the necessary qualifications to go ahead and become a TD and a judge. So I started that process, and I think I'm in my 10th year right now of officiating.
I love that, because that in itself is inspirational, that it is possible. If you've got the dream and you want to make something happen, you don't have to have necessarily an extremely big setup at home. You don't have to have tons of upper level horses. You know, you can work hard, learn, and people have obviously been extremely instrumental in your journey to be able to get to that point. You can now both TD and judge all the way up through intermediate. I know you've got big plans to go up to international TD level as well. What has that taught you now in terms of the next generation? Because I know that that's something that you feel really passionately about as well. It's obviously had a huge impact on you and getting to you to this point.
Definitely. So there's a famous quote that to be the person who you needed, and that is directed towards more of the younger generation. So be the person to the younger people that you needed then. But I think that in general, you just need to be that person that you needed. That is in our entire lives. So we can give to others what we maybe were missing. And it doesn't take a lot. It just takes, whether it's sharing knowledge, whether it's having coffee with someone and giving them just a little bit of information or a little bit of support, or the people that have really helped me have done just that. They have been the people that I've needed. So for a couple other official friends that are in the same generation and myself, you know, we routinely talk about how we want to make sure that we give to the other officials that are coming up, not necessarily younger than us, but the newer officials, we want to give them all of the tools that we have, because there's no secret. Like, there shouldn't be a secret in what makes a good official or what makes a good professional, what makes a good equestrian. It's all of it. There shouldn't be some secret to life. It should all be shared. So to me, I think that's really important, that we continue sharing our knowledge, and by having those conversations, it actually makes us better. That makes sense.
100%. Be the person that you needed, I think, is my new favorite line. I think that is extremely, extremely relevant to say, and all of us can apply it to everything in life, and we can intertwine it in our everyday life, whether it be in the equestrian world or outside of it. What about the future as an official? What are your hopes? I know I mentioned qualifying as an FEI TD, but what would you really love to achieve in that respect?
So I originally had this whole goal that I wanted to be maxed out on what I could be as an official by the time I hit 40. I'm now 41. I'm a large R TD and event judge. And I'm actually really happy where I'm at this moment. I think potentially international at some point could be in the cards. I'm going to be on a ground jury this spring. I've really enjoyed being an assistant FEI TD and working with the international officials in that capacity. But right now I'm actually kind of just enjoying riding, and I'm enjoying my horses. And I think a lot of times that makes us better officials when we're competitors, because not only are we aware of the rules, but we're also aware of what the competitors experience. And so we have that empathy towards them. So when you have that fence, it's not like, oh, too bad, tough luck. It's, you know, I feel that.
Yeah.
Really unfortunate. There is another day, and in 30 minutes, life's going to be better.
Yeah. And I guess what we're going to come on to talk about in a minute has actually made that even more of an important point in your life as well, because obviously your life has changed over the last 12 months and over the last couple of years. First of all, let's talk about your horses, because you say that you had lots of different challenges, and you rode sort of anything that might have come your way when you were younger. I absolutely love that some of your best horses have come from not the most obvious of starts in life, not the most obvious places. They perhaps didn't look the most talented. They've all been a little bit quirky. Have you got an eye for that? Have you always felt that you believed in them? Or do you get a real pleasure out of actually unlocking their potential? Because they have been tricky along the way.
They definitely have. So when I was younger, I hated riding the difficult horses. And all I wanted was to ride something that had an education and a good mind. And that's not to say that the horses I ride don't have good minds. They just have minds that have to be discovered or cracked into. You have to crack the code. So my father always told me he wished he could buy me like the best horses in the world. And like I said, we just never had the money. So I learned years ago. So the way I bought my first upper level horse was after he ran away with me for the probably 12th time in a cow field, I couldn't get any rhythm in the trot, and it was a disaster. So he was at that time a 4-year-old thoroughbred that had raced unsuccessfully. And so I told the people that were selling him, I was like, can you take him down to the bottom of the field? I'll watch him gallop up. Let's see his gallop. I'll video it. I'm going to buy the gallop, basically. And he had the best gallop I've ever seen. And I showed it to a friend, and she goes, you know, well, what do you think? And I said, I think he's feral, but I really like his gallop. And so she said, well, buy him. Like, just buy him. Why are you like even considering anything else? She goes, the rest of it, you'll just have to fix. And he had a fabulous walk, and he had a great canter. And he tore down dressage arenas all the way through the then 2-star level, so through intermediate. And I think more than once I had judges terrified that he would be safe to go cross country. And so with that, I have a lot of empathy for riders that you can tell they're just trying to keep the pieces together to get through the test. And the horse clearly is just mentally not wanting to participate. So when I judge that, my heart breaks for them. And maybe I shouldn't say that, but, you know, the scores obviously can't reflect. They have to reflect what's occurring, not what my heart feels for them. Yeah. So for those riders out there that are dealing with the horses that are difficult on the flat, I definitely feel their pain. But he turned around at 9, and all of a sudden He loved being a fancy prancy dressage horse, and he was incredible. That being said, he was probably the best cross country horse I've ever ridden. And at intermediate, he ever only had one stop, and that was probably out of, I don't know, a dozen events. And just before his move up to advanced, I lost, at the age of 9, I lost him to colic, to a nephrosplenic entrapment. So that was sort of like, I finally got his mind, and then I lost him. So it was unfortunate. But he was very safe cross country. He was very safe show jumping. He just didn't really want to play in the sandbox. Most of the horses that I've had have been like that. They've been either failed at something. One was a grade one stakes winner and a winning steeplechase horse here in the States. And he actually, his training partner was Union Rags, who won the 2011 Belmont. Anyway, he ended up going on and becoming a fabulous master's horse with a hunt, and the hunt was shutting down and the master was liquidating the horses. And so he was going to an auction. And again, through this horse, I ended up making an incredible friend for life, because I went to look at him and I was like, well, I can't afford to pay that for him. And she goes, I really like him. I'll help you buy him. And so, not even knowing me, just, we had mutual friends in common. She became a partner on this horse, and we have this incredible friendship, and we've traveled all over the world together. So again, horses kind of have brought that into my life. And he was a runaway with me, like on cross country, because that's what he always done. But you could put a 13-year-old child on him and he would just take extra special, perfect care of them. And he's continued, you know, I ran him through prelim. I did an amateur flat race on him, which he won. And I was mildly terrified, but it was a wonderful experience. And, you know, now he's back with his other owner and he's raising a young thoroughbred, and he's eventing with her and giving her some miles and some like confidence. So that's really cool, you know?
That's amazing. And I think the love for these horses absolutely shines through. It is about the bigger picture for you. Let's talk about the life change and the injury that led to you making the decision just over a year ago to have your leg amputated. Because obviously you've had a really active life. You've competed up through international three-star level. You know, you've got a family, you're busy. So what led to that decision, and how hard was that decision for you?
So a total freak accident in Berlin. We were riding, the family wanted to ride cruisers. So we're riding cruisers from the wall down into West Berlin. And there were some trolley tracks, and I grew up mountain biking and have raced in triathlons through the 70.3 distance. So I'm like, oh, hey, if I'm going to hit that, I'm probably going to fall. So I thought I had come to a complete stop, and clearly I didn't, at which point I became a lovely physics experiment. And I went flying through the air and attempted to land it, I think as most people probably would. And when I got up, I was helped up by these two ladies who I later learned were physicians having lunch at the cafe across the street. And I put my foot down and it detached from my leg. And so they drug me out of the street. I went into TD EMT mode and I started telling everyone where my passport was, where my, you know, of course this is in Germany, so I'm speaking English and I speak quickly. And I was like, has anyone called an ambulance? I need an ambulance. Like, and I'm trying to get a vein ready because I'm like, I really need some drugs right now. Like, this is really, really painful. I'm going into shock. Could someone get me some water? And so my husband and daughter were there, and they're just kind of like, you know, having to watch this all occur. And so I was loaded up in an ambulance, and I was very fortunate, taken to one of the best hospitals in the world, Charité, which is a university hospital in Berlin. And they proceeded to try to put my, they did give me some drugs when I got there, and they proceeded to try and set my leg four times, no success. And so they took me into surgery on that Sunday afternoon. It was July 14th. That is a day that can, for multiple reasons, can be erased from the calendar. But they took me into surgery, and I went in with a 50% chance of losing my leg, or they would put it in an external fixator, which is like an exoskeleton that comes out of your leg to try and put the pieces together. So at that point, I kept my leg. And a week later, they took me back into surgery to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And when I came out of that surgery, I was told that the damage was a lot worse than they were had expected and what the images had shown, and that I should make a full recovery, but it was pretty bad. So there was one doctor that I'd seen the entire time, and he was a bit of a masochist. Actually, he's probably a bit of a sadist is what he was. And he would come in and he would flick the metal rods coming out of my leg that were put into my bone. And every morning he did that. And so after the surgery, or right before the second surgery, they'd brought in a surgeon from Switzerland to oversee me because they didn't know what to do. Like, I was just kind of a hot mess at that point. And that morning, the sadist doctor was like, oh, and, you know, you have so much arthritis in this ankle. Like, what did you do? And I was like, well, I run ultra marathons. And he started laughing. And I was like, are you laughing at me that I run, I like would run in the mountains and stuff. And I've been injured before. And he was like, no, no. And so that evening he came in with the Swiss doctor. And I was like, I pointed at him. I was like, he laughed at me saying that I shouldn't have done what I did. And there's no way I did it. And it was just kind of funny. I was like, you don't know what people have done or what to think of them until, you know, just don't make expectations or don't make generalizations about someone. Right. So anyway, so I left that going, oh yeah, I'm going to be able to return to running and be able to return to riding. And I got back to the States, and my horse at the time had qualified for, I actually had two horses, one that belonged to a friend that I was leasing and then mine, that had both qualified for AECs. And clearly I was not going to be riding, because this was July, I was not going to be riding in September. So I nixed taking my horse to AECs. My friend's horse ended up being sold by my daughter. She showed him to someone and they bought him. And so I ended up going up to AECs with a cast on with two horses, because my child was going to come and ride in the TIP championships the following week on my horse. And so here I was, like, in a cast on crutches with two horses going up north, one to be shipped out and one to go compete with my child. It was like wild. Anyway, so I got to jump with a cast on, again, totally terrifying everyone, because that seems to be my lot in life. And that was at the end of AECs. I went over to a friend's place and we played around a little bit, and he'd been riding my horse all week. And anyway, so fast forward, I'm back riding, back competing, and I had entered, I did the, my event back was the training 3-day at Haggard at Team Challenge in October. And then I was like, well, I'm doing this, so I should be able to go run a 1-star on this horse, because he was competing prelim before this accident. So we went to Virginia, and everything had been going okay. A bunch of upper level riders like Courtney Cooper and Laura Vandervliet had been fabulous and told me their stories of heroism and success in overcoming badly broken legs. So I had chalked it up to, this is going to suck for a while. I'm going to have to become best friends with Ice Buckets, and it's going to be okay, because all these other totally badass humans have overcome it and moved on. And I was out on cross country and a really bad storm rolled in and I could barely walk. I was just walking the course and I couldn't even like get to a jump to get out of the weather. I was like dragging my leg behind me. And at that point I realized something was pretty wrong. So I went and saw a really fabulous orthopedist whose daughter used to event, and he's retired military, so and was highly recommended. And he was like, yeah, this is pretty bad. Eventually, you're probably looking at fusion, maybe an ankle replacement, but you're 39 years old, so I'll do what I can to kind of keep you moving along. And I was like, I have a marathon tomorrow. I'm supposed to be pacing people to the finish. Do you think I can do it? Like, I haven't, keep in mind, I haven't run, and now it's November, right? And he's like, yeah, I don't think so. He's like, maybe we can get you through one more marathon, but I think your running days are over. And I was like, nope, wrong answer. Like, you can't tell me that I'm not going to run again. He goes, but I do understand the riding thing. He's like, you people have a problem. Like, all of you people that ride, you have an addiction, and I'm not going to encourage it. He's like, but this is a healthy one. So I will do what I can to help you keep riding. And I appreciate that, because to this day, he has fought for me so that I can continue riding. And that's probably the one of the greatest gifts that I've been given. Anyway, so that sort of began the whole series of seeing more doctors, getting more second opinions. He referred me to some doctors, other people that are friends that are female physicians referred me to other female orthopedists that rode to try and get an answer that would be acceptable. And in December, I had an MRI, and that follow-up was, I was told that within a year, I probably wouldn't be able to walk, and I definitely wouldn't be riding. And so I began my own research, because I was dealing with terrible chronic pain that, like, the drugs were not touching, the pain meds weren't addressing. And I found a couple different options, and I started realizing that every doctor I saw, I would have to change the question. So instead of saying, what about an ankle replacement? I would have to say, why am I not a candidate for an ankle replacement? And I'd have to put people on the spot a little bit to educate me. In the process, I had to stop TDing because it's quite a physical job. And so I was like, oh my gosh, like, I worked for a vet, pretty much full time as a vet tech. And she's one of my dearest friends, and I've worked for her for years, and I couldn't work. So I was like, I'm going to have to do something. Like, I have just, like, lost my career. And I didn't quite realize this until I went to therapy, because I was having horrible nightmares, and I was reliving the accident over and over and over again. So when I could finally fall asleep, I would just experience these terrible, I mean, it's PTSD, but it's not the same PTSD as, like, someone that has experienced, you know, say war, right?
Yeah.
And, So I can't even compare it to that, which, anyway. So eventually in the spring, we tried an AFO, which is basically a brace that would make my leg so it couldn't move, but I couldn't ride in it. And this is the same brace. It's the ideal brace. And it's the same brace that they use for the military. And people have gone back to being able to do all the things with it. But one day I went in to see the orthopedist, and he said, hey, he's like, I think you need to check out this study. It's called the METALS study, METALS. And it's the military did the largest study ever to gauge, I think it's 340 participants, to gauge the success of lower limb amputation versus salvage, and upper body amputation versus salvage. So they actually found a pretty, in my opinion, successful outcome for people returning to regular activities by amputating a lower limb, whether that's a below knee, so transtibial or transfemoral, so above knee, or even through knee, to people that they tried to salvage the limb for years, and the people just were living with pain. And so that gave me even more drive to try and start figuring out, like, what I could do to be able to return to normal life. So you go through a process of seeing a psychiatrist. Anyway, in the end, the decision was, we're going to go ahead with amputation is the best thing to be able to go forward and, like, live my life. And the day after my 40th birthday, I met with the final orthopedist of the entire, so I think I saw 8 doctors after returning to the States, or 9 doctors. And I talked to him at length for about a half an hour. And he's like, okay, well, you know, would you consider a total ankle replacement? Because I'd be willing to do it, and you're not a candidate for a revision, because in 10 years, we'd probably have to amputate because the damage to my leg was so bad. But he goes, you're sort of an exceptional story, and I'd love to have you as a case study and do a journal about you. So I considered it through the weekend. At that point, I was competing down at Majestic Oaks in Florida, and I went back.
Were you still riding? Sorry, Melissa. Were you still riding?
I'm riding the entire time. Like,
but you're just
so
in
I had
excruciating pain.
Oh yeah.
And the mental side effects of it were just incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm still riding this entire time. So the moment that I could get back on a horse, actually, before I was supposed to be back on a horse, because we never ask like when we're allowed to do it, we just do it, right? The moment I could get back on a horse, I was, and I did not stop. So, I went and saw a pain management specialist. They gave me, so here's where it gets a little bit like not so pleasant to talk about. So they gave me opioids, and that was sort of their answer. The opioids didn't work. They put me on gabapentin, which is Neurontin, which is for nerve pain. I could max it out, and it didn't touch me, and I could use it in conjunction following the prescription with the opioids, and it did nothing for me. And so we tried acupuncture. We tried pretty much everything, and I was getting zero relief. And this is because there was a bone spur that was growing from my tibia, or my cannon bone, basically, into my talus, which would be like my coffin joint. So if you can imagine a bone spur growing down into your horse's coffin joint, probably not going to be the happiest experience.
No.
It's probably going to be pretty crippled. So that was sort of like, eventually as it grew down, I lost the ability to put my heels down. And when I saw the final doctor, and he looked at me when I stood up, he goes, you can't even stand with your foot flat on the ground. And I couldn't. And so he's like, all right, I fully support this. Like, let's do it. So, that was like the 14th of January, 2021. And a couple of weeks later, I had a date for February 9th.
Well, I think, sorry, we should just say all of this is going on through COVID times.
Yes, this is all going on during COVID.
Everything.
Yes.
Like
even
hospital appointments, medical appointments, everything is so much more complicated. So you get to the, you get to the middle of the January. And I take it that was when actually, do you know what you said, this is what I've got to do now.
Oh yeah. Like I was, so all of my friends, and it was a bit of a joke, but there was truth to it, that if it was written on my medical card back when we had medical cards, for my armband, that if I fell off, amputate my left leg, like get rid of it. I'm done. It doesn't matter. And you broke your right. Like, I don't care. Cut off the left leg. Like, let's move on with life. Just, it was that bad. It was, and I fell off a couple times, and I just got angry because I couldn't hurt it. It had rods in it. It was terrible. And mind you, I'm competing at modified, trying to get my horse back to prelim, but I didn't have the ability to use my left leg enough. So at the end of all of this, some days I could jump around a 1.20 meter course, and some days I couldn't jump a cross rail because of the pain. I would land wrong, and it would just, the rest of the day I was useless. So that was difficult. I mentioned that, like, I knew I needed to go back and find a different career. And so one night in all of my pain, as I was looking at prosthetists and trying to see what there was in the area for what could be my future, I found this link to schools and sort of like, there's a need for prosthetists and orthotists. And I clicked on it, and I was like, hey, I'm only like, I don't know, 24 credits away from being able to go back and do a master's in this. So I started exploring that. And in March of 2020, I actually went back to school, and again, during COVID, and I took all the prerequisites that were necessary to go do a master's program. So
That was before you had your amputation that you were already thinking
before.
Because I guess you had lost your career. Your riding was very, very different to what it was before. The psychological trauma of it was huge, and the knock-on effect of both of those things. So you then had already thought of retraining. So how did that tie in then once you had gone through with your surgery?
So I actually started shadowing, because that's part of the process, is you have to shadow a prosthetist and an orthotist at the end of 2020. I was listening to a podcast, and there was this organization on called Amputee Blade Runners. They're out of Nashville. Nashville's like 7-8 hours from us, and was reaching out to every single person I could find that had experience with, in my case, it was my choice to have the amputation. This wasn't a medical necessity. It was my choice to try and like regain my life. And so I reached out to them, and the director wrote back to me and he said, "How far are you from Savannah, Georgia? And are you willing to drive down there?" It's about a little over 2 hours. He said, "Are you willing to drive down there and you can meet with this person? And yeah, maybe you can even shadow him." So I drove down there and I showed up, and he hasn't been able to get rid of me since. Every week I come down here. So before I even lost my leg for about 4 months, 3 months, I had been coming down and spending 1 or 2 days a week in Savannah at Reform Prosthetics. And I talked to patients and I heard their stories and I asked them questions. And they, as a collective, have been like another person that I've needed in my life. And the day before surgery, so the weekend before surgery, I competed on Saturday, moved my young mare up to, I guess she's still a mare, up to training, her first training. So that was on Saturday. We did her first training. She jumped around double clear cross country. It was fabulous. And then Sunday we had a going away party for Lefty, and everyone came out.
Lefty's the leg.
Right. And we did a Zoom. And so people from all over the world, were on there, and it was just amazing. And everybody, like, people wrote on her. My dressage coach, Janice Lenan, wrote "more leg." I mean, it was really good for the soul, and it kind of wrapped everything up. I mean, we had mimosas, and it was just like, I walked around in the mud because it was raining and it was cold, and just had this like final experience with my foot. It was really cool. So then early Monday morning, I drove back down to Savannah. My husband came with me because surgery was on Tuesday, and I had my last day in the clinic. It was the last patient that I saw is this amazing gentleman with a really heroic story. He was in a motorcycle accident. His wife was killed on scene, and he flatlined a couple times and then ended up losing his leg. And he'd been just a really amazing human to talk to, and had continued doing like amazing charitable work after all of this had occurred. And he was, I think, less than a year out at the time. But I asked him, I was like, "So these phantom pains that I keep hearing about," I said, what is your experience with them?" And he said, "Well, right now it feels like someone's pulling my toenails out." And that was what I went into surgery with, is knowing that I might have this pain afterwards where it's excruciating and it might never go away.
Did you ever doubt, you know, you'd obviously done your research, but you were still able to compete, albeit in a lot of pain. Did you ever have the doubt that said, "This might not enable me to carry on the life that I want to carry on, that it's not going to fix the problem?"
So I said to my orthopedist that when it got to the point that I couldn't ride at novice anymore and it was really affecting my riding, I would tell him, and that was time. And that was sort of, I'd kind of tried to keep a really open mind and, like, you know, not feel this frantic anxiety that I needed to do something and just try and sit with it, which is really difficult for me because I like to fix things. But I made this decision that I was going to kind of sit with the discomfort of this decision and the unknowing. And when it got to a point where I, you know, if my leg gave out or whatever, that would be the time that it would occur. And that happened in November of 2020. Like, I was going down to a fence, the horse, you know, started to kind of back off a little bit, and my leg gave out from underneath me and she stopped, and I had nothing. And so I was like, all right, well, this just made life very clear.
Yeah.
And I can't gallop downhill. I can't do down banks. I don't know how I rode that last event before surgery, because I couldn't untack my horse. And I do not encourage anyone to live their life like that. And it's, you know, you should be able to do all of the things yourself, but when it gets to a point where you can't, having that support team is just incredible.
So talk to me about after surgery, because how, obviously you had done a lot of research, you had spoken to a lot of people, but nothing can prepare you for the actual reality of it. How was that reality?
I woke up and I was like, okay, cool. Here's where we are. It was kind of like that. And then the pain, you know, the block starts to wear off and the pain starts in. And the first couple weeks were rough. I will be very honest. They were extremely difficult. But again, people were just incredible and came out and would come and sit with me. And sometimes I would just fall asleep while we were talking because, you know, part of going through a major surgery like that is you follow their pain management, like to a T. You don't want to be a hero. You just follow the pain management. And so, you know, I'd take my pain meds and I did the things I was supposed to do. And sometimes I would just fall asleep like mid-sentence. And I had to accept that. So there was a lot of sitting around, which is, again, something I've never been good at. And a lot of watching movies. My husband has a really cool federal job and his coworkers all sent treats and presents to the house. And, you know, one hooked us up with HBO Max, which was sort of a godsend to keep me entertained, so I didn't drive everybody nuts. But yeah, like it was just kind of rough. And it was like, I wanted to do my things. I wanted to go down and see my horses. I wanted to like be back involved in life. But I knew that like everything was taken care of. So at a month, I got to sit on a horse. Again, a good friend in Aiken has this lovely draft cross mare that she'd bred and she's hunted and done all these things with. And so she offered that I could go sit on her. I didn't have a prosthetic yet. I was still months away from having a prosthetic, but I went and I rode her and I figured out sort of how to live my life, and how to do things. So I learned how to mount again. And, it was more like getting on bareback. I would just lay across the back and then swing my right leg over. And then, I was able to, like, you know, walk, trot and canter. And that was cool because that gave me the confidence that like things are going to be better and it's going to be okay. And then right after I finished judging in Washington in May, I had a little, looked like a blood blister on the end of my leg. And I was like, oh, this just doesn't look right. I went to visit some friends up in Bellingham and afterwards, I was just like, this isn't right. The next morning, I went to urgent care and the doctor was like, you know, if I was at the ER, I'd really put you on some IV meds. If things don't, I was supposed to fly home the next day. So that was on a Tuesday morning. I was supposed to fly home Wednesday morning. He's like, if things don't change like quickly, I think you need to go to the ER. And so with that, I just took myself over to the ER and they checked me in and the doctor took one look at me and she's like, I'm sending an orthopedist down. And they admitted me into the hospital. And the next morning, that blood blister, which happened to be an abscess, and it was an infection that had not been caught since the beginning of the surgery, it blew and on the bathroom floor. And I was like, I'm not going home today. I'm here. This is bad. So I was 3,000 miles from my husband and my daughter. And while I'm from the Northwest and I have friends in that area, I was pretty much alone because they wouldn't let anyone in the hospital because there was an uptick in COVID again. So I had these amazing nurses that would sit with me, or they checked on me regularly. I would order cookies for them to be sent to the hospital, and because I had no other way to thank them. And so that Wednesday, infectious disease doc came in. It takes a few days for them to do a, you know, to get the sample back and everything. And he's like, you know, these antibiotics aren't working. We're going to increase the antibiotics because when I went into the hospital that Tuesday morning, I was going septic. So like not the thing you want to experience necessarily. And Wednesday night, the orthopedist came in pretty late and he's like, so it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when you're going to have surgery. He's like, I'm not going to send you home to go have surgery, but you're going to have a revision on your leg, which means my leg has already been cut off once. They're going to cut more off. And at that point, I had to come to peace with the fact that I might actually lose my leg above the knee. And you want to keep as many joints as you can in your body. So when you're a below knee amputee, you're really not limited. And it's not that people that are above knee amputees are limited. It's that the metabolic output is that much higher. So I use about 30% more energy than the average able-bodied individual. A person that's an above knee amputee or a transfemoral uses about 60% more energy than the average individual. So, and it's just that much harder on your body because of how the prosthetic is set up. So I was like, all right, so this is kind of what I'm looking at. And okay. But when that orthopedic surgeon came in that night and he told me that, I was just, I had nothing. I couldn't do anything. And so this lovely nurse came in and I asked her if I could just talk to her. I said, I need some advice. I don't know what to do. I am so lost. Like, I'm alone and I'm lost. And it's 1 o'clock in the morning at home. And so I can't call my husband and say, and cry to him. And so as I'm having a little bit of an anxiety attack and kind of freaking out about, oh my God, I'm going through this again. And like, now I'm doubting if I should have ever done this. First thing in the morning, infectious disease doc came in and he was great. And he's like, so you're having surgery today. And I was like, wait, what? We're having surgery today. But I went in going, it's going to be okay. Like, this is going to be okay. And I'll make it the other side. And I did. So had a surgery on, I think that was Thursday or Friday. And then went through the weekend. Monday had another surgery and that closed everything up. And it turned out that my surgeon's daughter rides. And then all of a sudden we had this something in common. And he like really had value with the fact that he wanted me to get back riding, which was really cool. And my anesthesiologist, it turns out his daughter's an event rider. So it was just like all these people that had something in common. And there suddenly became this goal to like get me back so I could do what I wanted to do again. And knowing that I probably was going to be a little bit unrealistic expectation wise of how quick the recovery was going to be the second time around. So that was the middle of May. And I came home 2.5 weeks later. I had to stay out there because they wanted to monitor me. So I was able to stay with some friends that have a therapeutic riding center. And that was good as well, because I was able to sit in the barn and just heal. Like just sit with the horses and spend my time reading books, drinking coffee, being with people that are really, really great humans and just heal. So I came home and my mare was qualified. At this point, I'd already sent my young horse to a friend in Aiken, Jessica Schultz, and I'd asked her to ride her for me and get her ready. So before I went out, before the whole revision occurred, I was back jumping her with and without a leg thanks to Jess's help. And she was probably the only person that wasn't outwardly terrified every single time I got on the horse. Like, she'd ask me if I needed help, and then she'd let me do my thing. And it gave me, kind of gave me some freedom that I really needed, because an autonomy, like I needed to feel like I could do things myself again. So the mare was qualified to go to area championships at novice. And so I asked Jess if she'd ride her, and she did. And so I showed up on crutches and I crutched all my way around Stableview on crutches with one leg because I wanted to get to see my horse compete. And then a week later I had a prosthetic. I had a test socket. So to try and like help get me used to the experience of having a prosthetic leg. And again, I'm jumping, but I hadn't jumped with a leg yet. So I went to my first show, which was a schooling show, and jumped around and was one of the only double clears, which was really fun. But again, I was back to having to have everyone help me get on the horse and then take the horse when I got off, and I'm on crutches. And that kind of just sort of started everything. Like a week later, I went and did a combined test. I walked my show jumping course on crutches because I couldn't handle walking that much. And I think she won the combined test. And then I went and I did a schooling horse trial, the Eventine Academy at Stableview at the end of the month, and walked the day before you get to go out in cross country school. So I walked my cross country course on my horse's back and went novice, and she won on her dressage score. And this is a six, this is a, at the time she was five. So this is a 5 year old. And in the process, I was looking at doing para, you know, trying to get classified as a para equestrian for dressage. And my horse isn't old enough to even do para dressage. They have to be six. So here's this 5 year old thoroughbred Stormcat, by the way. She's a Stormy Atlantic granddaughter. So she has lots of opinions, sometimes that are not correct. And she's going around and she's winning at novice with me and like taking care of a para rider. It's like, to me, it's mind blowing.
Their sort of level of intuition is just incredible. Do you think she does take that extra mile for you?
So before I even lost my leg, we started preparing her to do all the transitions off my thigh and my voice. And she is extremely difficult for anyone else to ride because of that, because most of us don't ride off of our thigh and with voice. And she has been like, she has just stepped up and been amazing. All that being said, she turned six and somehow the spawn of Satan has come out. So I'm not quite sure, like,
he's a teenager, you know, now.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So I have I have a 16-year-old human teenager and a 6-year-old equine teenager in the house. I'm like, oh, like so many hormones and emotions. And
I mean, it has just been incredible to get to that point where you're competing. You're obviously much more independent in that respect. What about now? What can you do? What do you find are the challenges? And has it been, you can only prepare yourself for what it would be like, but has it been very different to what you thought it would be like?
Yeah. So before I embarked on this activity, this path, my prosthetist, he's also an amputee, and
he said to me, you know, I want you to write down your goals for 3 months, 6 months, and a year, and I'm going to look them over, and I'm going to tell you how realistic these are. And it was a really good activity for me to do,
because he came back and he expanded on them. And through all of this, I've been able to look at those goals and sort of see where I'm at. And that was frustrating with the setback in May. But like one of my goals was to qualify for the AECs at beginner novice and be able to potentially go. Now, I didn't go to AECs this year because I thought it was going to be a little too tight with everything that occurred. But the week before AECs, I went out and won a novice, a recognized novice with my mare. So it was great to see that, like, even though there were these setbacks, it really, like, all kind of came to fruition. Like, I wasn't out of my mind with the goals. And, you know, and he's commented throughout all this, like, you know, hey, this is where your goal was, like, you were set for this. And I even wrote in, like, you know, I'm going to have applied to schools by this point, and I'm going to have taken the GRE, and this is the score that I needed, and this is what I need to do. So it was, you know, we're supposed to do these things anyway, right? To get to where we want to be, like, look at the big picture. What's your goal? Let's work backwards from there. And how are we going to accomplish it? It's a great skill, and it's a great tool to utilize, but I don't think many of us actually do it. You know, we go, oh yeah, I want to do this 2-star, but I need to have these 4 prelims because it's a long format, and or 5 prelims or whatever. And, you know, this is what I'm looking at, and this is sort of like my backup events in case these other ones don't go well. And now how am I going to afford it? So we look at it that way, but we don't look at, like, my goal is to go to the Olympics, say, well, what are we going to do to get there? So, like, you have to look at that big picture and then make those decisions. So, like, that's been kind of cool because I've hit all of the milestones with the exception of my running. And that's a totally different story because of other issues that I've run into with my body and the years of and miles that it's, like, covered. So, but, like, as of right now, I am unlimited. When I saw my orthopedist in, I believe it was August, right before I did my first horse trial, he looked at me and he goes, you are completely unlimited. There are no restrictions. You can do whatever you want. And he signed off on all of my para paperwork at that point. So that was kind of cool. And so with that, like, I had one surgeon tell me that I would never live a productive life, and that I should just get my ankle fused and enjoy being a mother. And I am quoting him. He said, I should enjoy being a mother and a wife and let my husband take care of me. And I hope that anyone that's listening to this gets really angry by that, because that is not what we should say to anyone. And I was very fortunate that my doctor's assistant, who is also a upper level event rider and now in medical school, was there, and she heard the whole thing. And I told him to leave as he proceeded to tell me what I should be doing. Like, maybe I could play pickleball, which is a great sport, but it's not mine. So that's for somebody else. But he left, and she, like, was holding me because I was in tears. So, like, you experience these things, and it's not just going through this experience. It's the things that kind of, like, pick at you as you're getting to the end of it. And so finally you're like, yeah, let's just do it all. So I've enjoyed checking off the list of things that I used to do that everyone said I couldn't do, or people said I couldn't do. Some people said I couldn't do. Like this spring, I went out to Colorado with a friend, and I went to an adaptive program in Crested Butte, and I went skiing and snowboarding, which I used to snowboard competitively and ski. And so I got to check that off, and we went hiking in Moab, and I haven't been hiking without crying in pain in over 2.5 years. So I've been able to do these things, and it's great. I can walk a cross country course again. I can walk distances. It's like the greatest thing.
Are you pain free now?
So I don't have pain. I have phantom sensations, and I have them constantly. And all it feels like is my foot's asleep all the time. So it's that little, you know, pins and needles, and it's down where the foot is, but it's annoying, but it's not something that, like, stops me. And I always said I could live with pain if I could do the things I wanted to do. And now I am pain-free, although I have sensations, and I can do the things I want to do, which is really what it comes down to.
It's the most extraordinary story. Tell the listeners what you did for your ampuversary. I just think this actually sums up your journey to get to this point now.
Yeah. So yesterday, so as this is being recorded, yesterday was February 9th, and it was my 1-year ampuversary. And I went fox hunting with Bell Mead, which is a live hunt in Thompson, Georgia. And a lovely friend of mine that I've known for years and I've hunted with and I've ridden his horses and stuff. I asked him, I said, you know, I really want to go hunt. Would you take me? And he goes, yeah. He's like, let's go. I'll put you on, you know, my good horse. And, which all of his horses are good, but there's one that I've ridden since he was a 5 year old or 4 year old, and he's now 15. And, we went hunting and I rode second flight and jumped all the things, like all these crazy coops out of crazy footing. And, I was really good until I had a bit of a run into a tree. It actually ended up, my leg was on one side of the tree and the horse was on the other side, and it twisted the socket on my leg. And I was good for about another 45 minutes, half hour. But I couldn't trot. So I was fine cantering and jumping and in 2 point, but I couldn't handle the posting. So we went back, and at that point it was getting dark, and we got back about the same time as everybody else. So it was awesome. Like, it was great. I can't imagine a better way than to, one, I got to spend the day riding horses. So I rode my own horses in the morning, and then I got to go ride a fabulous hunt horse in the afternoon, and then incredible people. And the best part was, like, other than the fact that my friend was very proud of me for hanging tough with everybody all day, so he was telling everyone afterwards about my limb loss, not a single person knew that I was a foot short. And no one would have thought any differently. Like, they were surprised. They're like, oh my gosh, we saw you like galloping down to that fence, and you, wait, what? You're missing your leg? Like, what?
It's just incredible. And like the journey you have been on over the last 2.5 years, I can not even imagine how difficult it has been at times, and the challenges that you have faced and overcome. And I honestly cannot thank you enough for sharing your story so honestly with us, because it really, really does mean a lot. And listeners, I hope that you've enjoyed it too. What advice would you give somebody that is facing a life-changing experience, you know, whether it be limb loss or whether it be something else? What advice, what have you learned from this?
So one, I think finding a good therapist, it doesn't mean you're crazy. It just means that you have someone to give you a slightly different perspective. Therapist is like super important. There is nothing wrong with it. We talk so much about mental health these days. And I think that we need to embrace our own mental health a little bit more. So finding a therapist, definitely important. I think you need to do the research, because you can't expect other people to provide it for you. Don't be afraid to ask. Like, I keep hearing on these amazing podcasts about ask. That's all you have to do is ask. And you would be surprised that 2/3 more people will actually say yes if you just ask. And I know you're putting yourself out there, and it's a little bit uncomfortable, and it's a space that most of us don't want to be in. But ask people that have gone through it for advice. Ask if you can go apprentice with someone. Ask if you can go shadow. Just ask, and you'll be surprised that the answer is usually yes. You know, I'm finding this now, looking for a para horse, and I just kind of throw it out there. I'm like, hey, I'm looking for a horse that could potentially go to the Paralympics in Paris. I have the coach. I have the ability to do the riding. It's third level. So if someone has a horse that's coming down from the upper levels, you'd be surprised how many people are out there trying to find horses for me, because I can't afford to buy a para horse. So it's one of those things, like, someone's going to hear your story. Someone's going to find out about you, and they're going to be like, wow, that's really cool. I want to be a part of that. And then magic's going to happen. And it's pretty amazing. And the other thing that I would say is just keep showing up, even if it's really tough and you don't think that you're quite up to where you should be, and you feel like maybe you're not sure. Just keep showing up, because the answers are going to come to you. And I say this because the first 4 months that I was apprenticing with this prosthetist, I was exhausted. I wasn't sleeping. The chronic pain was just it was constant. And I get up at 4:30 in the morning, 4 to 4:30 in the morning, and I drive 2.5 hours to be here. I spend the whole day with patients and trying to learn new techniques and new activities and new skills. And then I drive 2.5 hours home, and I usually get home around 9 o'clock at night. And so it's a really long day, and there's still life that has to happen in the process. But I made a lot of mistakes, like a lot of mistakes. And I would have to ask him to repeat things. And I look back on it, and I don't know why he allowed me to keep coming back. But every day I was like, all right, I'm going to see you next week, right? Waiting for him to say no. And every week he was like, yep. He's like, can't wait to see you. And he's become a valued friend and just an incredible human being that, like, he has again given me, he has been that person that I needed. And he's that person for so many other people. So he's also a Paralympic gold medalist in running. He set world records. Like, he's an incredible human, and he doesn't talk about his accomplishments, but he's just there to sort of support and help other people accomplish their goals. And so I think if you just keep showing up, those people come into our lives.
And you never know where they might meet you as well.
Exactly.
Look, I love that. Yeah. I absolutely love that. And we will look forward to hopefully cheering you on in the Paralympics in Paris 2024.
Well, thank
you.
Fingers
crossed, LA 28 would just be amazing.
That would be, and if I can't find a horse, I'm going to have to make my own. So I think maybe 2028 might be the debut for the thoroughbred in the Paralympic.
You never know. You never know. Hell, somebody might be listening to this. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. You never know. Melissa, thank you so, so much.
Thank you so much, Nicole.
It's been an honor to listen to your story.
The only other thing I would say is, if anyone is ever experiencing something like this and they need someone to talk to, I am available, and you can find me on Facebook or Instagram, and I will always help anyone that I possibly can. So yeah, good luck to everyone that's dealing with whatever is facing them in the future.
There you go, listeners. If it sounds like something that you might need, get in touch. Look, I'm going to leave you with the two lines that stood out for me throughout that show. Be the person that you needed, and the greatest people meet you wherever you are. A huge, huge thank you to Melissa for sharing her story, and a huge thank you, listeners, for coming along for the ride with us. We hope you enjoyed it. We will be back very soon with more on the USCA official podcast.
Thanks for listening to the USCA official podcast. If you have any suggestions or feedback, then we would love to hear from you. Get in touch through any of our social media platforms at US Eventing, and don't forget to subscribe on your preferred podcast platform to make sure you don't miss an episode.